Hello and welcome to Alexander Disease Research Update, episode number 18, recorded November 16th and 17th, 2023. I'm Albie Messing from the Waisman Center at the University of Wisconsin. And for the first part of this podcast, I'm joined by my co-authors on a recent publication, Dr. J.P. Yu and Nicholas Stowe from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. J.P. is an associate professor of radiology, and Nick is a graduate student in the neuroscience training program. JP and Nick are both new to the podcast, so I'll ask them to say a bit more about themselves before we begin. Nick, let's begin with you. What led you to wanting to get a PhD in neuroscience and why imaging?
For sure. Thank you for the opportunity to be on the podcast. Really happy to be here. And I guess I'm really fortunate. JP being my past mentor for the last 4.5 years, he really instilled this great passion to seek out knowledge. And the biggest thing that always pops up every day is more tools in your toolbox, the more ways to look at the world, more ways to analyze. And so that is really how it came about to doing a PhD in neuroscience and getting really involved of helping people and giving back, and especially just learning more tools. And then imaging, I'll be honest, originally imaging, I didn't really know that much. And then it was a deep dive with JP, and thank God I had a great mentor and guidance, because it was a lot. But I love every part about it. And I think it really just provides another facet of just understanding both science and the mind and body and stuff. So that's kind of my short story, I guess.
Okay, great. Now, JP, tell us about yourself and how you got to be interested and willing to work on rats.
So as Albie mentioned, also thank you very much for this opportunity to spend some time with both you and Nick here. I really appreciate it. I have a lot of gratitude for that. You know, as Albie had mentioned, I am a physician scientist here at the University of Wisconsin. Clinically, I practice as an adult and pediatric diagnostic neuroradiologist. So I interpret CT and MRI scans of adults and pediatric patients for anything involving the brain, head and neck, spine, so on and so forth. The reason I'm really interested in imaging is because it's really one of the most facile, easy ways for us to really understand, you know, disease that occurs within the human body, and importantly, to do it non-invasively and very, very quickly. And for the longest time, imaging has, especially neuroimaging, has been very good at identifying anatomic disease. That is to say, let's say you have a brain and you have a brain tumor. Imaging is really great because I can tell you where the tumor is, where the tumor might be growing, and that will help guide our neurosurgeons and our neurologists. But with a lot of other diseases, like say Alexander's disease, it's really not a disease of, you know, anatomy. Like there's not a mass for us to really target. It's really a disease of biology. And the reason that we do the work that we are doing is because we're really interested in trying to understand how to extract biology from our MRI and CT scans. And in this particular case, and with Alexander's disease, it's going to be with MRI. And so I had the great fortune of just very obliquely, but very impactfully meeting both Albie and one of our other co-authors, Tracy Hageman, both at the Waisman Center. And we really kind of got very interested in Alexander's disease and really took this advantage to really start a deep dive into this disease.
Well, thank you again for both of you for being here. Before we get started, please send feedback and questions to axdrupodcast@waisman. That's waisman.wisc.edu. So the paper that we're going to talk about in this first segment is by Nick and the rest of us, and it's entitled Quantitative Diffusion Imaging and Genotype by Sex Interactions in a Rat Model of Alexander Disease. It's just been published in the journal Magnetic Resonance in Medicine. So first of all, why don't you can take turns, and it's your choice who wants to talk first. What was the main goal of this study, and what do you think is the key message for patients and families? We'll come back to that at the end too.
So referring to the main goal, like JP mentioned, we had the great opportunity of this collaboration and really applying this in up-and-coming advanced technique for diffusion weighted imaging when it came to MRI scans. And so we really wanted to tackle this translational aspect of looking at this rat model of AXT. And to our surprise, we were able to recapitulate or show similar clinical findings that were found in the human population, but also explore new avenues when it came to certain brain regions and other, as I mentioned in the title, a gene by sex effect, of course. I'll let JP add on more there, but that's kind of the general goal.
JP, before you weigh in, let me acknowledge that the title of this paper and the text itself use a lot of terms that are not really familiar to anyone but MRI radiologists. In the title, it's quantitative diffusion imaging. In the text, we talk about neurite density, orientation dispersion, mean diffusivity. These are really highly technical terms. So JP, the patient family community is familiar with the kinds of diagnostic imaging that's used for patient care. How is diffusion weighted imaging different than the conventional diagnostic MRIs that everyone knows about?
Sure, that's a really great question. Classical clinical neuroimaging techniques are very nonspecific, and we can get sort of broad strokes in terms of where neuronal injury might be occurring and sort of the extent to which that injury has occurred. What those types of traditional neuroimaging techniques tell us is not more sort of very specific changes that might be occurring in the brain. So specifically in this case, in our paper, we were interested in the actual structure of groups of neurons. So do these neurons have more connections or less connections to the neurons that are around them? What is the direction with which these neuronal connections are made? Are they made more globally, or are they somewhat restricted into certain neighbors around them? And to Albie's point, that's really what this paper is to try to get a sort of a more of a deep dive to kind of get an understanding of how the brain is actually organized instead of just looking at gross structures that we see in the brain with classical MRI techniques.
Well, there are two things about this paper that really came as a surprise to me. One was that we could do it at all. Imaging in a rat is hard, and some of this is dependent on the strength of the magnets that are used. But the second has to do with something that was referred to in the title, the genotype by sex interactions. Clinically, there's been an argument going back and forth from the beginning about whether boys are more affected than girls, or in the older groups, maybe women are more affected than men. It's never really been resolved. The most recent interpretation from the human literature is that there isn't much of a sex difference. But in the rat model, using these advanced imaging techniques, we're picking something up. Can you say something about that and what implications that might have for the future?
Yeah, we did find very interesting points, certain measurements where, you know, females, for example, had an increased amount in a certain measurement versus a decrease in another measurement. And it was very stark. You know, if you look at the papers, look at the graphs, it's very, very apparent. And yeah, in my literature research, could not really see a clear defined thing here of, you know, trend of this finding in the clinical population. So I think not only is this interesting, I think it shouldn't be seen as a worrisome thing. It should be viewed as like a interesting avenue to look further into, you know, is this strictly happening in an animal model? Do we maybe potentially need to revisit some of the clinical findings? So I think it really just provides more avenues of exploration and what exactly is happening. You know, I think we can come to some conclusions like we do in the paper, but, you know, I think further and further research will help validate more about exactly what's happening. Is it just a rat specific change, or is it happening also in the clinical population?
And can you also say whether this is a sex difference that's apparent maybe at a lower level in the healthy controls, or does it just appear in the Alexander disease rats?
So in our analysis, we only saw these changes more pronounced in the female Alexander animals that we imaged.
So let me turn to some more general questions about radiology. Do you see these kinds of quantitative methods becoming useful in a diagnostic setting, or are these strictly research tools?
They're absolutely the coming wave. One of the major things that we need to do in terms of precision medicine is we need to quantify exactly where the disease is, how much of disease is there, and where the disease might be going. And in order to do that, we need to actually quantify exactly what is happening. And that's something that we don't do clinically right now. And what this research is really doing is sort of setting the stage and providing the background to make this next step in clinical radiology.
Okay, and now I'm going to throw the big question on everybody's minds in all aspects of life, or almost all aspects of life right now. Is there a future for artificial intelligence in radiology? In pathology, diagnostic pathology, where I had a lot of my training, people are talking about that more and more, that in some cases they can train computers to read slides as effectively or maybe even better than pathologists, which is a very strange thought. But I don't know if you've been thinking about that in radiology.
So interestingly, clinically right now at the University of Wisconsin, we have over 30 different artificial intelligence algorithms currently running on clinical timescales in our clinics right now. Almost all of those implementations of artificial intelligence have nothing to do with medical imaging, which is really, really surprising. It's mostly having to do with everything that happens before the imaging actually happens. Myself and some colleagues a couple years back actually published a series of papers looking at how good artificial intelligence is in clinical radiology. And the too long don't read, story is that it's pretty bad, which is kind of surprising. And the reason is because imaging and artificial intelligence is, as many people know, is only as good as the data that's given to these models to build these models. And if the data is bad, the outcome and the result, the output is also going to be bad. And so what's really interesting is for rare diseases like Alexander's, we actually don't have a lot of imaging data to train an artificial intelligence algorithm to detect Alexander's. And so that sort of begs the question then, how do you actually diagnose Alexander's? And the way you do that is with quantitative imaging and with just good old-fashioned human medical school residency and fellowship training.
All right, so my last question is for this kind of research project on Alexander disease, what do you want to do next?
As JP was saying, the main goal of the lab was this translational aspect, looking towards the clinical population. But the most powerful thing when it comes to a rat model is also being able to track and record recovery mechanisms and gene therapy and such. And so I think we'd really look forward to seeing if we can record some type of recovery or some type of rescuing of the disease in the rat model and seeing how those quantitative measurements can pick that change up and what do those quantitative measures look like. But I'll let JP add more, of course.
Yeah, so Albie and Tracy have come up with a brand new sort of drug to help treat Alexander's disease. And so the question is, can we track those changes with imaging? And if we can, the really beautiful thing then is when we actually move into human patients and we start treating our, human clinical populations, we'll have a way to evaluate whether or not the treatment is working and whether or not we've reached a therapeutic endpoint. Or we can tell our docs, say, like, nope, we're not quite where we need to be. Maybe we need to increase the treatment length X amount of time. And so that helps the patient and the physician and treating team to get enough treatment to get to the therapeutic endpoint that they need.
I have a feeling we're going to be writing grants on this topic for quite a while. Thank you again to both of you for talking about this today, and I look forward to having you again on a podcast in the future.
Thanks so much
Thank
for
you so
having us.
much.
Now for the second paper that we'll talk about today by Jung et al. And the lead author on this is none other than Amy Waldman, who needs no introduction to everyone. The title of this paper is Acquisition and Loss of Developmental Milestones and Time to Disease-Related Outcomes in Cerebral Alexander Disease, published in the Journal of Child Neurology. Amy, this may be the first paper to emerge from your natural history study on Alexander disease. Do you want to briefly go over the goal of the natural history study and then the specific goal of the particular analyses you did in this paper?
Absolutely. So first of all, I'm delighted to be here speaking about our first paper coming out of the natural history study. So it's very important that we understand all the nuances of this disease. It is no surprise to our patients and their families that this is a heterogeneous disorder, meaning people present differently with different symptoms at different times of their lives. So it's incumbent upon us to really understand the clinical course that our patients go through. More importantly to me and the history of this paper, there's still a lot of misdiagnosis out there, or delayed diagnosis, or quite honestly, physicians get lucky in that they recognize there's a genetic problem and they send broad genetic testing, and then they realize that there's a mutation in GFAP causing Alexander disease. But there's still a lot unknown about this disorder. And then there's a lot of misconception about the progression of Alexander disease and skill attainment and skill loss. So for all of those reasons, we organized this paper to really help people not only understand how to diagnose Alexander disease, but the clinical progression that ensues.
Okay, so what was the main hypothesis or question that you wanted to address in this paper?
Before we get started, I just want to mention that for this particular paper, as we were looking at early development and the milestones, we focused on the 51 individuals in our natural history study who had the cerebral or infantile type 1 Alexander disease. We came up with the questions. Number one, what are the earliest clinical symptoms in Alexander disease? Number two, how do they progress? And number three, what is the impact of developmental delay or developmental loss, so skill loss, on disease outcome? We found a number of things. Number one, which is a good thing for our disease community, is that most patients do obtain many of the gross motor skills, not always ambulation, but they do in time learn to sit, learn to crawl, and sometimes learn to walk with or without assistance. That's very positive for our community. We had a very high proportion of patients that were able to obtain some sort of ambulation, even with a walker, which is exciting for our patients and their families. The earliest clinical finding is actually developmental delay. And it could be mild, but it really is developmental delay as an early clinical finding, followed by seizure, followed by macrocephaly, which occurs much later. Now, that is not to say that every patient is going to follow that algorithm. Certainly, we had patients in our cohort who presented with a seizure that had no developmental delay and were not macrocephalic. So this idea does not apply to everyone, but why it's so important is that we want to get the message across to clinicians that they shouldn't be looking for macrocephaly in order to make the diagnosis of Alexander disease, because it could be a later finding. And that they really should have a suspicion for Alexander disease, even in patients that have provoked seizures in the setting of an illness, when they have some mild developmental delays. So really trying to educate physicians about getting to the diagnosis much quicker.
Well, I think we've known for a while that many patients never have macrocephaly. So I guess I wasn't aware that people really honed in on that as a key element of making them think about leukodystrophy or Alexander disease. What was a surprise to me was that seizures weren't the first manifestation, partly because seizures are really obvious, dramatic. People notice them. And developmental delays, as you say, you realize very slowly and sometimes only in retrospect. So that was a surprise to me that the seizures really weren't the earliest manifestation. When you talk about developmental delay then as the earliest problems, what are the earliest developmental delays that you see?
For many of our patients, they sit late. So they achieve head control Rolling in general is a little bit later now that for maybe 15 years now, children have been put to sleep on their backs. So rolling happens around 5-6 months, whereas many years ago, it used to happen around 4 or 5 months. But it's really the sitting that starts to get delayed. So they can sit with support, but you're looking at sort of, you know, 7 or 8 months or 9 months, as opposed to the 5-6 months that most people are expecting. Then crawling becomes late, standing, and even walking is all shifted. And we do share the average age of these milestones, which I think is important for our community. And so the average age of children who are able to walk independently was just under 2 years. So everyone thinks about walking around your first birthday. For many of our patients, it's closer to the second birthday.
Another thing you looked at was whether the age at which some of these problems became apparent predicted anything about future course. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. So I think everyone has the idea that Alexander disease is classified in different ways, including the neonatal form, the infantile, juvenile, adult. And there is, again, this idea that earlier onset is worse. So neonatal seems to have a worse prognosis compared to the infantile. So, and that generally goes without saying that the earlier you're diagnosed with something, perhaps the worse it is. So we have this idea that if you develop symptoms early, for example, before you turn one or before you achieve walking, right? So if you develop symptoms after you've gained your developmental milestones, maybe that's more protective. But if you have symptoms like a seizure or even macrocephaly very early before the developmental milestones are achieved, our hypothesis was that would portend a worse diagnosis or worse prognosis. And that's so important because in the clinical setting, if you're seeing a patient and they have a seizure and they've not yet learned to walk, now a patient with Alexander disease specifically, if they've had a seizure and they've not yet learned to walk, it was very important for us to be able to say, okay, this is a child that may not walk. That was our hypothesis, right? That if you had those earlier symptoms, maybe you weren't going to develop your developmental milestones. And we actually did not find that, which is very important. So once again, to say it a little bit more clearly, we did not see a correlation between some of these earlier symptoms and your achievement of walking, nor did we see a correlation in those who achieved walking and their other outcomes, including the outcome, sadly, of death, right? The idea that, okay, well, if you never achieved walking, maybe you were more likely to succumb to this disease early. And we did not find that either, which is a little different than what is perhaps suggested in the literature.
When you think about the whole spectrum of Alexander disease in the entire age range, earlier onset is worse than later onset. But I think the message here is that when you're looking just at this early onset cerebral or type 1 group of individuals within that category, you can't really try to use age of onset as a predictor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, you know, Amy, a couple of years ago, Davide Tonduti published a paper also on developmental milestones in type 1 Alexander disease and thought that he might be able to discriminate four subtypes of type 1, depending on how they achieved developmental milestones. How did your findings match up with what he found?
Great question. So clinically, I agree with his four outcomes. Right. He suggested that there are four different courses that our patients take or patients follow, including an early fatal course, which we have lost some patients very early on in their disease. He then says that there is a deterioration for some patients less than 6 years of age. There is a deterioration that occurs in the latter part of the first decade. And then there is deterioration or stability that goes into adolescence with a deterioration much later in life. So I definitely agree that there are those four outcomes for these patients. What we were not able to replicate was the predictors. So for example, he suggests that if you never achieved ambulation, that your deterioration occurs less than 6 years of age, and our data does not support that observation. I agree with him that there are a group of patients that do decline, and then there's a patients that decline later, but we were not able to tie these outcomes to these motor milestones. And so that's a big difference between our paper and what he's previously published.
So there's still a lot that we need to learn about this, and we still are not very good at predicting future trajectories for patients. Okay, Amy, so what would you say is the key message of your paper for clinicians and for patients and families?
For clinicians, the key message is to think of Alexander disease, even in patients with mild developmental delay and provoke seizures. Do not depend on macrocephaly or the triad in order to confirm a diagnosis. And the reason that's so important is because we don't order MRI scans in all patients that have mild developmental delay or that have a provoked seizure, a seizure that's provoked by illness. So that's the key message for clinicians. The second message for both clinicians and families is that we really should do aggressive therapies because we've shown that our patients can achieve milestones even if they're shifted in terms of the time of acquisition. So let's not give up. Let's be more aggressive with therapies so that a patient gets physical therapy if they're not walking in a year, because many of our patients won't walk until they're two, and we have to be very aggressive with the therapies.
Well, let me ask one last question, because you use this phrase, provoked seizures. Many people won't know what that means. Can you explain?
Well, let's start with the term febrile seizures. Pediatricians and neurologists diagnose a febrile seizure in a previously healthy child who has a fever and an illness and then has a seizure. But not every child that has a seizure in the setting of a febrile illness truly has what we would diagnose as a febrile seizure. What I mean by this is if you have mild developmental delay, then you have some differences about your brain and you shouldn't be using the term febrile seizure. In that case, it is a seizure that has been provoked by a febrile illness, but it's not the same thing as a febrile seizure. So a little nuanced, but I want to make sure that we use the proper term. If a child has developmental delay and has a seizure that has been brought on by a febrile illness, it really should be termed a provoked seizure, and we should reserve the term febrile seizure for someone who has been developmentally appropriate.
So do they have a lower threshold for temperature in order to provoke that seizure?
Absolutely. They have a lower threshold for a seizure in the setting of a febrile illness, a fever and illness.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We look forward to the next paper from the Natural History Study.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to talking about our next paper soon.
That's all for today's episode of Alexander Disease Research Update. Thanks for listening, and thank you to JP, Nick, and Amy for joining me today. Our theme song was written by Charlie Allenson. Special technical assistance from my daughter Zoe and Rebecca, and from Clark Kellogg at the UW's Weizmann Center. And thanks to our donors for these podcasts, the Barrett-Riddle family. I'm Albie Messing. See you next time.